This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. You may be noticing an uptick in polarizing political factions lately, even within the two major political parties. So is an inter-party insurgency a new phenomenon? Or can we look not too far back in our political past to find examples of struggles for political power arising on the fringes? Joining us now to talk about that is assistant professor in the Carl Albert Congressional Research and Study Center and the Department of Political Science at the University of Oklahoma, also author of the upcoming book, How the Tea Party Captured the GOP Insurgent Factions in American Politics. It's our friend, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Dr. Bloom, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure to have you. A little later on, Rachel and I will be joined by Mashable reporter and MissInfo.com writer Matt Bender to talk about the rise of QAnon. And we want to talk to you as well. So feel free to give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk at WVXU.org. Rachel, so you've got this new book that's on its way to coming out to the public, How the Tea Party Captured the GOP Insurgent Factions in American Politics. And you start this book with a recollection of your first visit to a Tea Party meeting, and you learned a little bit about what they were really concerned about, it seems. So would you mind just recounting that tale for us?
Yes. I did a bunch of interviews and meeting attendance, and I went to rallies for several years when I was first studying the Tea Party. And from the very beginning, something struck me as not quite right about what the media account or, say my classmates in grad school's account of the Tea Party was and what the Tea Party thought it was. Because continually, in interviews one-on-one or in that particular meeting, which was at a Green Turtle restaurant in Fairfax, Virginia, the focus was on defeating the Republican Party. Now, they did talk a lot about how they thought Obama was bringing socialism to America, or the Affordable Care Plan was terrible because no one had read all of it, among other things. But the focus in terms of strategy was always on how they would actually infiltrate the GOP. So the meeting I start the book by talking about is one where they were gearing up for the 2013 Republican nominating convention in the state of Virginia. That state sometimes does primaries and sometimes does conventions for its off-year statewide elections. And that year, the Tea Party had pushed really hard to have it switched to a convention because they had a strategy for winning it, even though they knew they could only make up about one-third of the Republican delegates. Their plan was to use a convention structure, which lets you vote ballot after ballot on who you want to win, to stay in the game by being unified longer than all of the other Republican delegates who had split their votes between various other moderate candidates. And the long and the short of it is, I went to the meeting where they outlined the strategy and do the training for one of the bigger groups in the state. And a couple months later, I find out that they did exactly what they had planned to do and that they did, in fact, win. Their slate of Tea Party delegates was the slate of Republican delegates that year for the statewide elections.
And so this Tea Party movement, as it was called at the time, it's about 10 years old, maybe a little more than 10 years old at this point. And just pulling this from the title of your book, How the Tea Party Captured the GOP, when we look back a decade later and we have President Donald Trump, is this directly related to that Tea Party uprising?
I think so. This was something I really was thinking about as I got the book ready for publication, and especially as I was trying to work on the conclusion chapter, how to connect the Tea Party to Donald Trump. Because from my experiences talking to the Tea Partiers, I felt that there was a connection, but it was very, very hard to trace. A lot of the Tea Party groups that I had been working with had kind of gone underground or stopped meeting. And what I eventually came to realize as I was going back and trying to track all of those groups, and as I started trying to talk to Republican officials in a couple of states, was that the Tea Party hadn't disappeared at all. The Tea Party was the Republican Party in not only the states that I was doing interviews in, but by the time you get to the 2016 Republican primary season, there was a wing of the GOP that had very much accepted everything the Tea Party believed in, and they found a standard bearer in Donald Trump. And that wing of the GOP is the wing that you now see represented at the 2020 Republican National Convention, that you now see staying in power. It was the House Freedom Caucus. It basically is the new establishment.
Well, speaking of the establishment, what I find curious, Rachel, is that here we are a decade later from the first emergence of the Tea Party, and they are the mainstream of the Republican Party now. And what you see on the fringe are upstart organizations like Republican Voters Against Trump or the Lincoln Project, these formerly Republican voters or Republican politicians who are launching these massive campaigns against the Trump administration and his reelection campaign. So there, I guess, is that irony that now the establishment finds itself on the fringe trying to fight its way back in?
I think it is quite a bit of an irony. And it gets to something about that distinction between like insider and outsider, establishment and novice, whatever we want to call it. It is at times useful. Donald Trump was a political outsider in that he'd never held office. The Tea Party for Bill was outside of power. But if an outside group or an outside figure becomes successful, they're by default insider or establishment. And this was what made the Tea Party difficult to study, because they would have, say, a congressional candidate they really, really, really liked. And as soon as that person got elected to Congress and had to start making compromises and legislating, that person was no longer outsider enough. And Donald Trump has somehow managed to elude that trap, maybe by just being unpredictable, but to a lot of the people who sympathized with the movement or continue to draw from it, still seems like a little bit of an outsider.
Yeah. You know, I just want to share an anecdote. I'd seen a bumper sticker over the summer that really struck me as interesting. And it just said, "Trump 2020 because F you again." And I thought that's an interesting position to take, because it's not necessarily an endorsement of any policy. It's just an endorsement of a person and what he appears to represent. And that might just be anger towards people that you feel looked down upon. And so I guess that leads to the question of what exactly do the remainders of the Tea Party stand for now? If you can't spell it out, because goodness knows that the Trump administration has continued to run up deficits. The Affordable Care Act still exists. And these were key components of that uprising, and none of that has changed. And still, maybe more than ever, this wing of the Republican Party, which may be the mainstream of the Republican Party, still supports the president.
Yes, absolutely. I think the question what the Tea Party stands for now begs another question, which is what they stood for there. Their heyday, so to speak. And it never really was taxes, even though their moniker is taxed enough already. In the early days, maybe the first year or so, 2009, when they were organizing protests, they got a lot of support from libertarian funders who really, really wanted to train Tea Partiers in the ways of fiscal conservatism. And so we heard a lot of those cries, and I think that defined the Tea Party for a lot of people. But the libertarians pulled out of donating by 2010, 2011, when the Tea Party started to act politically, because as more Tea Partiers got elected and as more Tea Partiers used these tools in their local groups to start influencing state and local elections, it became crystal clear that they weren't really about fiscal conservatism. They liked some of that rhetoric. They liked the help. But really, they were about fear of this threat, a threat of change. And it's something I call status threat, that some others who've written about the Tea Party, Chris Parker notably, call status threat. And it's what happens when you are someone who feels like you deserve a particular place in the world, or in this case, in the country, and you feel like something is changing to threaten that. You become a little bit paranoid. You start looking over your shoulder to find someone to blame, someone to attribute all the change to. And the Tea Party, as I went on, as I came to be in Congress, increasingly was associated more with things related to threat. So I analyzed all of the press releases of Republican members of Congress in that book. And the difference between Tea Party affiliated members of Congress who were Republicans and non-Tea Party Republicans was actually on this. Non-Tea Party Republicans were more likely to talk about economic issues, fiscal responsibility, fiscal conservatism. Tea Party Republicans were more likely to talk about law and order, stopping immigration, our guns being taken away. So things that you could relate to someone who is not one of us trying to take something from us.
And we're talking with Dr. Rachel Bloom, an assistant professor at the University of Oklahoma and the author of the forthcoming book, How the Tea Party Captured the GOP, Insurgent Factions in American Politics. And Rachel, I want to read a quick piece from a Politico column that was first published back in May, and that kind of seems like a lifetime ago, even though it was about 4 months ago. It's by Rich Lowry. He's editor of the Conservative National Review, but he's also a contributor to Politico. This was published in Politico, and he says, quote, "We've also seen a return of the glue that has held moral traditionalists and libertarians together in the conservative coalition for so long, the belief that big government is a threat to traditional institutions, hence the focus on resuming church services and wielding the First Amendment to do it. In retrospect, the Tea Party wasn't as much a purely liberty movement as it seemed at the time. A populist anti-elitism was an enormously important factor, which is why it faded into the Trump movement so seamlessly. On the other hand, Trumpian populism has a big streak of liberty to it." And I guess my question from that, Rachel, is when we talk about elitism and Donald Trump, how do they remove the elitism from Donald Trump, who is a self-proclaimed billionaire who lives in a penthouse made of gold in the top of a high-rise tower in New York City after coming from a rich family and attending Ivy League schools? And he has all the makings of an American elite, and yet that doesn't seem to matter.
Yeah. So this gets to the heart of what's missing when we use things like populism or elitism to try to describe these relatively complicated political realities. And many issues with some of the sleight of hand in that excerpt you read. Populism is not a real political ideology. Someone named Cass Muda, who's written a lot about it in the European context, calls it a thin-centered ideology, meaning you can just use it to describe whatever you want if it suits your purposes. So Donald Trump and the Tea Party were only populist in that they use a lot of rhetoric of being anti-establishment or anti-elite. But what that actually means, I think, has more to do with status threat than with the pure people versus an oppressive elite, which would be the traditional style of populism. So in status threat terms, Donald Trump is aspirational. He's one of us in terms of the Tea Party or what Tea Partiers might aspire to. He's, as far as they know, self-made, although we know that's not completely true. Wealthy, he's in business. He doesn't have experience in government. He doesn't care what other people think of him. He's not politically correct. And he's white, and he's willing to cast non-white people as outsiders, as threats to the country. So in that sense, even though he is an elite, he is the kind of elite that a lot of people who the Tea Party resonates with want to be.
And we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Bloom just ahead. We'll also be joined by Mashable writer Matt Bender to talk about the rise of QAnon. And we want to hear from you at 513-419-7100, your emails at talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our look at political fringes with assistant professor in the Carl Albert Congressional Research and Studies Center in the Department of Political Science at the University of Oklahoma. Also the author of the upcoming book, How the Tea Party Captured the GOP, Insurgent Factions in American Politics, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Rachel, thanks for sticking around.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
And also joining us now is Mashable reporter and the publisher of MissInfo.com, Matt Bender. Matt, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
It's our pleasure to have you. We brought you on specifically to help us understand and explain QAnon. And before we jump into that conversation, we got a soundbite of President Trump being asked whether he supports or knows about QAnon. And Josh, can we hear that?
During the pandemic, the QAnon movement appears to be gaining a lot of followers. The crux of the theory is this belief that you are secretly saving the world from this satanic cult of pedophiles and cannibals. Does that sound like something you are behind?
I haven't heard that, but is that supposed to be a bad thing or a good thing? I mean, you know, if I can help save the world from problems, I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to put myself out there.
Matt, the president has openly embraced other conspiracy theories in the past, not the least of which was the birther conspiracy surrounding President Barack Obama's heritage. Matt, just first, can you help us understand what exactly QAnon is?
Right, sure. So QAnon began back in October of 2017. And basically, it all started when Donald Trump had a gathering of military leaders at the White House, and they all got together and just randomly, while talking to press, he just had this throwaway line that he said to them that was, you know, this is just all the calm before the storm. And that basically set off online conspiracy theorists and many of his supporters to believe that, you know, something big is coming. And, you know, this is already something that's being said to a group of people who already were believing of conspiracy theories like Pizzagate, which believed that there was an underground child pedophile trafficking ring going on in the basement of a DC pizza parlor. And so, you know, they hear this and they think, you know, he's speaking to us. And this all culminates when a random anonymous online user or users, it could be more than one person, we don't know, named Q started posting on image boards like 4chan and then moved over to 8chan. And basically this person would claim to be a high level individual in the government who's close with the president, and that they were giving, you know, breadcrumbs or secret hints to the people reading this stuff to basically keep Trump supporters in the loop about what's going on behind the scenes. And from this became the belief from most QAnon followers that President Donald Trump is fighting to take down the deep state in order to take down a global satanic child pedophile ring that's run by Hollywood elites and the Democratic Party.
Matt, that all seems rather intense.
Yes. But, you know, the way that we talk about it, though, we also need to specifically mention that this is just not true. Obviously, yes, child, because, you know, people hear this and they will say, you know, oh, I hear that Trump is trying to stop everything I just said. Sounds like a good thing, just like he said when he was asked that question at that press conference. It would be a good thing if, you know, he was actually doing that, but he's not, because this global pedophile ring run by the Democratic Party and the deep state and Hollywood elites, it doesn't exist. Like, yes, is there sexual abuse problems in Hollywood? Absolutely. Is there problems with child trafficking? Yes, absolutely. Do we see big cases like with Jeffrey Epstein? Yes, we do. But none of this is tantamount to what they're saying. And by focusing on this boogeyman, we can't actually deal with the real problems. We're just going to all focus on this imaginary global ring that's run, you know, that just happens to be run by these groups that
Trump political
supporters
opponents
don't like.
Yeah,
right,
yeah. So,
exactly.
So why is it settling on child trafficking? Why is that the issue?
Well, who could possibly support that? It's such an easy thing to be against. Obviously, everyone is against child trafficking. And, you know, what we've been seeing recently, actually, is QAnon online, especially since the coronavirus pandemic, is that, you know, QAnon first was mainly Donald Trump's most very online supporters, who then would share this information that they got from these QAnon from Q on these forums to a broader online Trump public, like, you know, mainstream Trump supporters on Facebook. And with the coronavirus pandemic, with everyone being home, they start hearing, you know, they start hearing from their family or relatives who hear about this stuff from these different Facebook forums, and they start spreading it beyond these Facebook groups. And then everyone's home, bored, they're consuming this stuff, and it sort of wraps in all these different things. You know, you have the Trump supporters who are solely focused on the Donald Trump aspect of Trump taking down his political opponents who are doing these bad things. But then, like I said, since the pandemic, you also have, you know, Facebook moms, you know, middle-aged women who are very protective over their children and hate to hear, you know, what these stories of, you know, sexual abuse against children, because obviously, yes, horrible things. But they hear this stuff from QAnon, and they get wrapped up into this world, and there you go. QAnon gains another member and continues to spread throughout the political discourse.
And we're talking with Matt Bender of Mashable. We're also joined by Dr. Rachel Bloom, an assistant professor in political science at the University of Oklahoma. And I want to talk to you both about this law in California where legislators amended the penalties as it relates to having sex with someone who is under a certain age. And the legal age of consent in California is 18. No bones about it. That's just it. But they have equalized, basically, the penalties for heterosexual relations that violate that and homosexual relations. And then you're seeing this outrage on right-wing social media now, and it plays into this pedophile narrative and child trafficking narrative. And though we may frame QAnon as being somewhat fringy, I just want to note that Laura Ingraham, who hosts one of the most popular shows on all of cable news, tweeted out just yesterday with a link to a Washington Examiner report on this that was characterized as Governor Gavin Newsom signing controversial bill into law reducing penalties for sexual relations with minors, which is probably an inaccurate characterization of the bill. Laura says, pedophilia on its way to being recognized as a protected lifestyle. Congratulations, California. She goes on to say, and happening nationally, if Biden gets to fill the courts. Donald Trump Jr. also tweeted out this morning with the same link, they're normalizing pedophilia. It's not just Hollywood and Netflix. This is now becoming mainstream Democrat groupthink. It's insanity, and we must stop it. The reference to Netflix is also of a recent controversy over the French film Cuties, which depicts some minors in some sexually explicit types of dancing. And Senator Ted Cruz is calling for a congressional investigation into the making of that film and the distribution of it here in the United States. So let me turn it over to Dr. Bloom here. We heard Matt explain QAnon to us, but with Laura Ingraham, Donald Trump Jr., Senator Ted Cruz talking about it, about similar themes that are raised by QAnon supporters, are we seeing it creep into the mainstream?
Oh, I absolutely think so. I also think that QAnon has touched the conservative mainstream at several points before now. As Matt mentioned, the Pizzagate scandal, and, you know, I'm using air quotes, was really popularized by Alex Jones of InfoWars. Steve Bannon of Breitbart has been a big player in moving some similar conspiracy theories even before QAnon, some that were especially popular with the Tea Party, like the belief that the UN's Agenda 21, which is a sustainability initiative, is some sort of world government takeover tool. These were all very popular with the Tea Party, but they've also touched a lot of conservatism through the organ of Fox News, which, since it became broadly available in the early 2000s, has provided a very, very concentrated take on political reality to many people on the American right. And Laura Ingraham is a fascinating figure in this, too. She, before her Fox News fame, was a talk show host and popular with the erstwhile Christian right, which was also a movement on the right that was very, very prone to believing conspiracies. So that groupthink rhetoric is just an updated version of the belief in the 1980s and the 1990s that Hollywood elite and the Democratic left were brainwashing in our public schools and through our textbooks. This is just the same kind of conspiracy belief in new clothing.
I want to note that Facebook, this is an article written by you, Matt, that Facebook announced a crackdown on QAnon and Antifa. And I want to raise Antifa because it's often characterized as a leftist organization. I don't know that we see too much creeping into actual policy, similarly to what I guess you could say about QAnon policies creeping into actual legislation. But what role does Antifa play in today's political conversation? You don't see a whole lot of mainstream Democrats embracing it the way that you might see mainstream Republican commentators embracing messages of QAnon, Matt.
Right. Well, the thing is, you know, the QAnon people, you could just see it on Facebook or online, the people who believe in QAnon are mostly Trump supporters. I mean, obviously, like I said, with the pandemic, it brought in a new crowd. But the base of QAnon is Trump support. Whereas Antifa are just individuals who are usually activists who basically show up wherever there's a right-wing rally or a white supremacist march, and they basically counter-protest that. Those people usually have politics far left to everyone in the Democratic Party, even the most progressive Democratic politicians. Many of them are anarchists or even don't even subscribe to electoral politics. They are just, they strictly just believe in anti-fascism, where the name Antifa comes from. There is no broad Antifa movement. Anyone who shows up, there's no group to join. There's no membership dues. Anyone who is against fascism basically can consider themselves to be Antifa. It provides the perfect fodder, though, for people who need a both sides to blame scenario. You know, you have QAnon on one side and Antifa on the other, where in reality, Antifa are against very real things, which are white supremacists and fascist people. And on the other side, you have QAnon, which believes in just made up conspiracy theories. And they're pretty harmful, if you ask me. These conspiracies.
And Dr. Bloom, I'm no political scientist, but I'm wondering if the order of events here just hasn't caught up to the Democratic side of things, because, you know, your claim in your book is, you know, the Tea Party basically took control of the Republican Party. The Democratic Party has not been taken control of yet by its more left-oriented members, although we are seeing more criticism from that segment of on that ideological side. Maybe it started with Bernie Sanders, and now it's moved on to support of other prominent politicians or commentators. Will the Democratic Party have to maybe be taken over by that group before you start to see another even farther, more out there position being taken? I guess what I'm asking is, the Republican Party went Tea Party first, and now you're seeing QAnon creep into mainstream Republican and conservative talking points. Will the Democratic Party have to go through its progressive reckoning before you might see a more open embrace from more extreme groups like Antifa?
My answer is tentatively no, but I'll separate those two things. The idea of maybe a progressive takeover, the Democratic Party, from the idea of Antifa becoming mainstream. And I'll start with Antifa. Antifa is a lot like Occupy Wall Street. And when Occupy Wall Street first started, right after the 2008 financial collapse, so early 2009, is also when the Tea Party first started. And for a while, everyone wanted to see this equivalency. So the Tea Party is to the right, or the Republican Party, what Occupy Wall Street is to the Democratic Party. And the problem was the same as it is with Antifa and as it has with protest politics on the left for a long time, which is that protest politics on the left does not want to be associated with the Democratic Party or any organ of political power. And that means that no matter who takes over the Democratic Party, if Antifa doesn't want to be tied to a Democratic candidate or to a political party, they will resist that, and they won't be, which is a little different than the Tea Party. Their main goal was to be part of the Republican Party, just a more powerful part. And that takes us to this question of a factional takeover of the Democratic Party. It's possible we could see one, but it relates less to how extreme or moderate different groups are and more to the structure. Because if we just think of parties as coalitions made up of lots of different groups who want things, if some of those groups are continually left out of the consensus, they can eventually form a little coalition within the party. And a coalition, we could call it a faction, if they use the right strategies to start hitting the party where it hurts. So state and local primaries, moving on up, that faction could take over the Democratic Party, just as the Tea Party did to the Republican Party and past factions have tried to do throughout U.S. history. But there is a way to avoid that, and it's possible the Democratic Party is avoiding that. You can keep a faction from forming by incorporating members of that faction into the party's consensus. So in as much as the Democratic Party has always been known a little bit more for having more diverse groups within it and having less consensus on one ideological line, it looks like they're trying to include and incorporate a lot of the progressive elements instead of just sidelining them until they become a force that's so strong that they can actually do a lot of electoral damage.
Kevin from Mason writes, I actually followed much of the news related to the Tea Party rallies from 09 to 10, and my most vivid memory is the racist signage and banners portraying President Obama as a secret Muslim, a terrorist, or a witch doctor. Therefore, it's no coincidence to me that there would be a through line between the Tea Party and the era of Trump's base today. Dr. Rachel Bloom from the University of Oklahoma and Matt Bender from Mashwell, I wish we had more time, and I think we're going to have to pick this conversation up another time. I've enjoyed talking to both of you and am grateful for the time you gave us and look forward to chatting to both of you again. Thanks so much.
Yes, thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.